and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. Today on the program, we have a couple of topics I think you'll find interesting. One of them is the possibility of growing vegetables in your home, and the other is how to plant a butterfly garden, and that's what we're going to start off with first. I'm talking with David Salmon of High Country Gardens, and David, we've talked before on the program. It's been a couple of years, but I saw an article that was recently sent to me from High Country Gardens about planting a butterfly garden, and I just thought, well, it's time to have David back on, so welcome again to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Brian.
Butterflies, of course, especially for me, I've noticed monarch populations diving throughout the last 10 years or so. When I was a kid, I used to go down by the railroad tracks in a little town that I lived in Mendon, and we would literally collect hundreds of caterpillars along the tracks. Probably should have been along the tracks, but anyway, so we'd take them home and hatch them and let them go. But boy, you sure don't see that anymore.
Unfortunately, monarch populations, for a number of reasons, have really declined to a precipitous level.
I mean, we're looking at what? Do we even have 10% of the population that we had 20 years ago?
That might be a generous estimate. I haven't seen the latest, but I know that things like a lengthy and extensively distributed drought here in the southwestern United States has really interfered with migration patterns and things like that. So, yeah, the monarchs are having a difficult time.
In your article, you mentioned how you got into the business that you're doing because of insects and devoting much of that time to studying butterflies in subtropical Houston, Texas. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, well, like yourself, Brian, I, as a kid, was fascinated by insects and butterflies and moths in particular. So for many years, I spent a great deal of time collecting them and also collecting caterpillars and feeding them and raising them to the adult stages. So butterflies were early on a very important part of my life, and now here it is. Gosh, 40, 50 years later, and I'm still involved with butterflies, and I think our efforts to help them are needed more than ever.
Now, you mentioned in here that it's no longer appropriate to collect the caterpillars and the butterflies. Do you mean to keep as specimens, or is it still okay to, if you find the caterpillars, to hatch them and still watch the process and then let them go?
Well, I suppose it's a little open to interpretation. Back when I was a kid, I had all my different butterfly nets, and I would be racing through the fields trying to capture the adult butterflies. Then I would euthanize them and mount them on a spreading board, and then they would go into my collection. And these days, that probably is not as appropriate just because the butterflies are not nearly as abundant as they were back then, and they're habitats weren't nearly as restricted and disturbed as they are today. So I think finding and raising caterpillars and releasing the adults is an excellent thing to do, but perhaps actually collecting specimens for, well, I actually donated my collection to Colorado State as I got older, but that's probably best left to professional entomologists.
There is a local group here in Cache County that asks for you to call and let them know when you've collected the caterpillars, and once they've been hatched, they give you they come out and will put a number on the wings because they're trying to identify the different migration patterns and so forth. So there's some a little bit of research going on up here in Cache County too with them.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the scientific study of invertebrates, which include all of the insects, is very important because there's much that we don't really know about them. And so in those instances, collecting is a very important part of the scientific efforts to understand butterflies and moths more completely. So in that case, it's absolutely necessary.
Now, when it comes to attracting them to your own yard, what's the first thing you're going to look at? Because I'm thinking, okay, well, monarchs, they're pretty host specific as far as where they're going to lay their eggs. It's got to be milkweed. I can't have anything else. But as far as being able to feed them once they've hatched, once they've become a butterfly, then you're open to more possibility.
Yes, well, butterfly gardening involves providing habitat, food and nectar plants, and water. So those are kind of the three basics. And in the case of monarchs, they are very food specific when it comes to feeding their caterpillars, and they need to feed on various species of milkweeds, which unfortunately, milkweeds used to be probably one of our most common native wildflowers, but because of agriculture and extensive use of herbicides and roadside herbicide applications, milkweed populations have declined also considerably. So part of butterfly gardening, if you want to attract monarchs, would be to plant butterfly weeds, the various species, because that's what the adults will lay their eggs on and the caterpillars will feed on.
Are there specific species that they prefer over another, like different cultivars? I've heard of some that are more tropical in origin that they don't like quite as much. How do you know you're getting what you need to have?
Well, I would say that there's a couple of primary species of milkweeds that are widely distributed across the U.S., and I believe that's Asclepias speciosus, and that's a big pink-flowered, broad-leafed species that is not the best-behaved garden plant, so I recommend kind of planting it in kind of peripheral areas of your garden, particularly ditches and places like that that might get periodically flooded after a rain. That's what the milkweed loves to grow in, so if you'll plant that species, monarchs are in the area, they'll lay their eggs and you'll see caterpillars.
So what is it about that particular species that makes it not conducive to planting in the garden, but more on the periphery?
Well, it tends to be a runner. It suckers readily, and so it spreads by underground roots. And if you have a naturalistic style of landscape, then it's a good one to let loose. But if you're a little more of a tidy gardener, you might be a little upset because it does like to spread. But, interestingly, the thing about monarchs is their distinctive coloration warns predators that because they've been eating milkweed, which has a very bitter compound to the leaves, that tells birds that might eat a monarch, leave me alone because I'm going to taste really bad because I've been eating milkweed.
And then that's kind of how the viceroy has, not the viceroy, that there's another butterfly that mimics.
Yes, it is the viceroy.
It is the viceroy, okay.
It mimics the monarch, and as many things in nature, very ingenious, sometimes unexpected, and very effective. So even though the viceroy's caterpillars don't feed on the milkweed, Asclepias is the Latin genus, they mimic the adult monarch butterfly, so the birds think, well, I better leave this fellow alone because he's going to taste bad. But in fact, he's completely edible, but because of the mimicry, he's safe.
I need to say thank you to Hillary, who just sent in the contact information for this group that tags the monarch butterflies. You can find information at cachevalleywildlife.weebly.com. And I've interviewed Ron Hellstern. He's in charge of the project. And you can contact him at redrockron@gmail.com. So thank you very much, Hillary. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can send us an email. It's zestygarden@gmail.com or call 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. So looking at the four basic elements of a butterfly garden. So you're first looking at the flowers and the food. And I've always wondered, how do you attract swallowtails? I see them, but I don't know what they eat.
Well, swallowtails, I remember as a kid, that was one of the most sought-after butterflies that I was always looking for because they are just magnificently beautiful and big. So in terms of attracting the adults, if you have nectar-rich flowers that they like, well, if they are in your area, they'll stop by for a sip. if you want them to become a part of your garden, then probably one of the most popular food plants for swallowtail caterpillars would be dill.
Dill?
So if you, yes, dill.
Wow,
so,
okay.
So you pickle picklers out there probably already have swallowtails in your garden because they that's one of their favorite food plants for the caterpillars. So dill is a good one. Also, tiger swallowtails, their caterpillars feed on ash trees. So as is often the case with butterflies, they'll have perhaps not a specific requirement for their caterpillars like the monarchs do, but in the case of swallowtails, ash trees and dill plants are good starts for getting them to come to your garden.
Well, this is my wife, if she's listening, is probably laughing because I can't stand dill.
So, whoops.
And she loves pickles, so she's going to say, you're going to have to plant those to get the swallowtail. Okay, and dill's a good one because it'll reseed and come back the next year.
Yeah, it's a biennial, so it basically is green the first year and then flowers and sets seeds the second year. But once you plant dill and allow it to naturalize, you'll have a nice population for the swallowtail caterpillars to feed on.
I'll put it back there with the milkweeds along the ditch.
There you go.
Okay, so what in the West? I mean, you're going to have some of the same flowers in New Mexico as we have in Utah, but there's a lot of different butterflies. So is there going to be a difference with what you plant in, say, St. George, Utah versus Cache Valley?
Yes, very definitely. Certainly the Cache Valley and St. George areas are very different in terms of their climate, St. George being much more moderate in the winter lows and much hotter in the summer, whereas the Cache Valley is a pretty cold spot. So you're going to have different butterflies, and different butterflies require different food plants. And, you know, while monarchs are widespread and their food plants are the same, many localized or populations of butterflies that tend to be more local, you'll need to do research in terms of what's in your area and what the caterpillars prefer to feed on. So a little bit of internet legwork will provide you with information on what's best to plant and what butterflies you might expect to attract in a given area.
So when you're looking at doing a mixture of flowers, I mean, you don't want to have just one particular one. How can you find flowers? What types of flowers do the butterflies like from spring until fall?
Well, I think it's important, Brian, for your listeners to understand a little bit about butterfly biology, in that the adult butterflies, that's who we see flying around, their nectar plants can be a much more general and broad spectrum of both annuals and perennials, whereas the caterpillars often have much more specific food needs in terms of their plants. And sometimes what the caterpillar eats isn't necessarily what the adult feeds on. But it's much easier to attract adult butterflies because they're generalists in terms of what they feed on. So things like butterfly bush, of course, butterfly weed that feeds the monarch caterpillars, the flowers feed a wide variety of adult butterflies. Oh, Laetris, basically a coneflower. Daisies are good for butterflies because they need to land and extend their coiled tongue or proboscis into the little individual florets. So small-flowered plants that have broad, flat tops are excellent for attracting butterflies. And flowers that have elongated spikes, like Laetris, and have, you know, hundreds of small little flowers making up the big flowering spike, those types of flowering plants are excellent for attracting the adult butterflies.
Do butterflies go after things with tubular shape at all? I'm thinking of a honeysuckle.
Well, you'll get some overlap in terms of, for example, if you're planting for hummingbirds, and their first preference are long red or orange tubular flowers. And while that isn't necessarily a butterfly's first choice, you will see them occasionally visit the flowers, but generally they like smaller, more numerous, what we call florets, which, like a cone flower, you see the petals, but actually the center of the flower has hundreds of these little florets. And butterflies like that because they'll just go from floret to floret, pollinating the plant and extracting the nectar as they feed.
I was wondering about Agastache because that's one that blooms really well in the fall and will give you some late season bloom for those caterpillars coming out a little bit later. Will that work?
Yes, Agastaches basically can be divided into large flowered and small flowered varieties. The small flowered varieties like our native Agastache funiculatum, which is from the upper Midwest, and Agastache neomexicana, their flower spikes are composed of many much smaller flowers than, say, some of the southwestern species. Agastache rupestris, licorice mint hyssop, is become widely cultivated, and those tubular flowers are much longer. So they won't come to Agastache rupestris as much as they'll come to the neomexicana or funiculatum, which have much smaller flowers. So with the right species of Agastache, you can absolutely provide lots of fall nectar.
So something with like you said, with the shorter flowers, it's easier for them to get to. I'm looking at this picture of a liatris that you have, and
yes.
And there's monarchs all over it.
Well, and then actually, the large flowered Agastaches will attract hawk moths, which mimic hummingbirds. In fact, many people are mistake these adult moths that feed typically at dusk for a hummingbird. And now, these have a much longer proboscis, and they usually feed on plants that hummingbirds like. So it's just amazing. It takes a little bit of study to find, you know, the right plants for the right butterfly. But in general, if you plant a diversity of flowering plants, particularly that bloom from the start of spring, and then you follow with other species that bloom in late spring, summer, and early fall, that's what's important to bringing adult butterflies into the garden by having a consistent source of nectar.
You mentioned the hawk moth. Isn't that coming from the tomato hornworm?
Yes, it is.
So,
which brings up an important point when someone aspires to be a butterfly gardener. You have to plant to share, and if you're out there spraying all your tomato plants in horror because you saw a hawk moth caterpillar, or it's an enormous, what we call a hornworm, then you're going to damage your butterfly population. So I always recommend, you know, plant an extra tomato or two, and don't spray for caterpillars, but just pick them off. And invariably, you'll miss some because they're experts at camouflage, and those will hatch to adult hawk moths, which you'll enjoy on sitting on your patio at dusk pollinating your flowers.
I suppose you could pick them off the others and put them on those host plants, those two or three that you've set aside.
Well, you could. I think that if when you're inviting wildlife like butterflies into the garden, a laissez-faire approach is best, because if you try to control things very precisely, you're going to be disappointed, because nature doesn't easily corral. So just plant a few extra plants, pick off what you see, leave a few, and then everybody's happy.
Well, we're talking with David Salmon, and he's with High Country Gardens in New Mexico. And if you'd like to join our conversation, we have about 5 minutes left. It's 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So let's talk about you've got shelter on here as something that is needed for the butterflies. How do you provide shelter?
Well, the key thing about providing shelter for butterflies is to leave a lot of your perennial and annual plants standing over the winter months. I know a lot of people are kind of in the habit in the fall of taking the garden down to the ground, but for both adult butterflies and the chrysalis or cocoon of the butterfly or moth, they often are attached to standing plants like a coneflower, for example, and they'll be hidden under the foliage waiting till spring. So you want to leave your garden standing over the winter to provide sheltered places for both adults and larvae, or rather the cocoons and chrysalises, to overwinter. Also, if you have like brush piles, maybe a small brush pile kind of off to the side, perhaps behind the storage shed so it's not real visible, but just leaving parts of the garden a little bit wild is also a good way to provide shelter, particularly during the growing season.
When would it you be able to cut down those perennials in the spring? How long would you leave them up?
I usually wait, unless they've been diseased, like, you know, you have powdery mildew on something, and then you do want to remove that in the fall so that the spores don't overwinter and then get started back in the spring. But generally, you want to leave things standing at least until mid-spring. When you start to see some adult butterflies flying around, then that's a good indication that their overwintering cocoons and chrysalises have hatched and the adults have emerged. So generally, mid-spring, okay. Once the day's warm and insects become active, that's when eggs are hatching and whatnot. So generally, mid-spring.
So don't jump too quick. Once the things start to warm up, to cut things down.
Absolutely.
You also recommend water.
Yes. Well, and there's for folks that like songbirds, you know, of course, you have a bird bath. But butterflies don't come to bird baths. What they actually like is a mud puddle. So leave some bare ground, and you may have a natural place where puddles form. Perhaps the irrigation from your lawn or something oversprays and provides a damp spot. But mud puddles provide both water and salt that butterflies find essential. So to provide water, just make a mud puddle.
Okay. And the mud daubers will come along as well.
You'll have probably have some swallows that might be making a nest. We'll pick up some mud. You'll have mud-daubing wasps. Mud puddles in general are a very useful thing for insects and particularly for butterflies.
And for kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the last item I wanted to make sure we covered was making sure that you have a pesticide-free environment, because that can be very damaging to all the life cycle of the butterfly.
Oh, that's just so important. Unfortunately, corporate America, who makes and markets insecticides, have tried to give us the impression that they can be used indiscriminately and very safely, and that's just not the case. And our insects are extremely vulnerable to insecticides. So when you're butterfly gardening, or really when you're just gardening in general, not only for butterflies but for yourselves and songbirds and whatnot, a pesticide-free environment is very important. And probably one of the most insidious groups of insecticides which are widely sold are systemic insecticides. And these are kind of a new generation of these. They're termed neonicotinamides. They're a very potent class of insecticides that can be sprayed on a plant, and then they're absorbed by the entire plant, but it poisons the flowers. So basically, if you use these insecticides, these systemic insecticides, you're providing a poisoned nectar for butterflies that visit the garden, which clearly is not a good situation. So garden organically. You just don't need to spray in the garden. In fact, I almost never spray, and if I do, it's a hard stream of water to knock off the spring aphids. Mm. So a pesticide-free environment is very important. And even using organic insecticides like BT or Bacillus thuringiensis, which is specific to kill pest caterpillars like tent worms and things like that.
Or the spinosad.
You spray your whole yard for tent caterpillars, you're going to infect the caterpillars of the species that you want. So You need to be very careful even when using organic pesticide formulations.
Well, David, we've reached the end of the time. Thank you very much for joining me. I do appreciate it.
Well, Brian, it's always a pleasure, and I hope you all are getting lots of good snow up there in Utah.
Some more coming in this weekend, I hope.
Good. Well,
yes.
We need to get our mountains covered with snow. That's lots of water for our spring gardening.
Looking forward to it. David is with High Country Gardens in New Mexico. David Sam was my guest, and we were talking about how to plant a butterfly garden. Coming up next, after a quick break, we're going to talk about growing vegetables indoors. So stay tuned. Welcome to this portion of the Zesty Garden. I'm Brian Earle, and with me today is Tom Bettis, who's USU's Extension Horticulturist in Utah County. And we're going to talk about the possibility of growing vegetables in your home.
Yes.
Okay.
It's possible, and it's not that you're going to be growing a half-acre garden in the living room, but you can grow herbs, which are a little more known, but you can grow other things also.
So like what? Because I'm thinking, wow, can I grow carrots? I'm thinking probably not
carrots.
What are the limitations?
Well, the limitations are the root crops. I have played with those, and they're harder to transplant. But leafy greens, lettuce works really well. The mustard greens work quite well. The situation that you need to create for those plants is similar to what they would see outside, and where they need light and proper temperatures. And if you can provide that along with good soil, then you can grow quite a few things inside. And we recently put together a little press release on tomatoes. And
that's what caught my eye.
Yes.
Like, okay.
Yes. And I've, for several years, here on campus, worked in the crop physiology lab under Bruce Bugbee, not directly, but with him and his students and things. And they have a really dwarf tomato called Microtina that they would use for all sorts of experimental work, whether it was monitoring for ethylene or space research and things. And these little Microtina tomatoes always fascinated me. And then I saw one in one of my fellow students' offices in the window, and he was just out there picking five or six of them off, dropped them in a salad, and ate, and I've sort of been fascinated ever since.
So how big are we talking? You're
going to want to
grow beef steak.
No, you are not. These Microtinas are released only for educational or research use. So those are only a half inch at the largest, usually around a third, maybe a little bit larger than that, but not much. But there are several similar varieties that if you want these super dwarfs, there's one called Micro Tom and Tiny Tim that very similar size that will only get about 18 inches high and wide in a pot.
So it's not only the size of the tomato, but it's the size of the plant.
You're
not going to want to get a cherry tomato that trails.
No, not unless you have a 5 or 6 gallon pot with drainage holes in the bottoms, and then you need to have the room and the proper lighting to do that, and you definitely can. It just depends on how much you want to turn your living room into a production area.
And my wife would say, well, it's already a production area. What difference is another pot going to be?
Yeah. So, some folks have those areas in their houses and things. And my goals in putting this together is to show that things can be grown, and you do not have to have a greenhouse to be able to do so. And oftentimes a greenhouse is not the best option.
Yeah, because there's expense.
There is.
Of putting it together. And where do you put it? And
correct.
The nice thing about this is the convenience of it.
It is. And if you're just wanting a few things we said in the press release, an occasional salad just to pop in your mouth, then these super dwarf tomato varieties are quite easy to grow, and the seeds are readily available online.
So how large of a pot are you talking about?
For something like Micro Tim or Tiny Tom, a number one nursery pot that you would buy a perennial in, that used to be called a gallon pot. They're not quite that big, but something that would hold the volume of a gallon of water would be perfect for those tiniest or the smallest
ones. And those are quite small.
They are. It's $2 or $3 in potting soil, some fertilizer, and you would want to make sure that you had light. So either a south window that's not too drafty, or basically cool white fluorescent bulbs about 6 inches over the top of the plant.
Yeah, you've got to keep them pretty close.
You do.
All right. So with these, what are you looking for? Because you're not going to be able to usually go to the garden store and find these.
No,
you're going to have to grow them yourself.
You're going to order the seed yourself. But you can go to a number of local businesses here in the valley or across Utah and purchase a little tray to start seeds in, purchase the right potting soil, a little bit of watering can, or even a sprayer similar to what you do your ironing with to keep the soil moist. And then once those things germinate, it's just transplanting them into a bigger container. Once they're up, you have about a 95 to 99% chance that they're not going to die on you, as long as they're not dried out or too wet.
And tomatoes are, I'm assuming these smaller ones too, are pretty forgiving as
they
far
are.
As of how deep you transplant them. And
they are, and it's not as critical as other plants. And so it's more getting over that hurdle of just saying, I can do this, putting the seeds on the soil surface and then just waiting that 7 to 10 days for them to germinate. And as long as you can provide around a 70 to 75 degree temperature, which tomatoes really like, once they're up, the right lighting, then within about 60 to 90 days of germinating, you should start to get some tomatoes.
And the tomatoes are, they look cherry tomato size.
Cherry tomato size, maybe the size of a dime or a penny.
Okay.
Would be the best way I can describe it. There's some, I've noticed that Burpees carries, I believe, a couple of varieties called Torrenzo, and there's one other that are a little bit larger. Those plants get about 2 feet, and if you're going to grow something like that, then you'd want a pot that would hold 3 or 4 gallons of soil.
And most of the medium that you're going to be used to growing these in, it's not going to be soil from outside.
Absolutely not.
This is going to be a potting mix that you bought in the store. It's
correct.
Probably sterile.
Yes.
So you'll need to be adding the micronutrients and the
yes.
nutrition that the plant needs.
You know, if someone can use something along the lines of a Miracle-Gro liquid feed or Osmocote granular, I bring those two names up because they're very common. A lot of people recognize them, but many garden centers, farm stores will carry several brands. And as long as you have the three numbers on the analysis, which are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, as long as you have those all filled with a number, whether it's a 4-5-5 or a 3-6-10, the important thing is that you have them all filled with something but a zero, and then you should have a decent enough fertilizer.
Do you have to worry about the micronutrients?
Not as much. A lot of times our water itself, it's not that it's contaminated or anything, but there's always trace elements in our water. And as the potting soil breaks down a little bit, some micronutrients are released there. And so I've not had too many problems just using a basic houseplant fertilizer doing this. And, you know, when in doubt, you can get a little package of micronutrients for a couple of, you know, $3 or $4 from a garden center.
What if you have a water filtration system? I'm just thinking, I was just using.
Then you would want to look for something more that backfills those micronutrients into it. But potting soil, just because, you know, it may say sterile, but they haven't taken the micronutrients out of the organic matter. And they had to have been absorbed from the soil at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And so to a certain extent, you have them there, and it will take a while for the soil to become depleted.
I really like those coated granule ones, because I'm not the type of person that wants to have to worry about feeding it every time.
Yeah, it has
so.
the hydrogels and things in there.
Yeah.
Miracle-Gro is famous for that. There's other brands. Miracle-Gro does a pretty good job on theirs, but you know,
I've used the Osmocote.
Yes.
So that
yes.
works pretty well.
Yeah.
But those tend, correct me if I'm wrong, they feed pretty steadily for the first, I mean, it says up to 3 months, but really you're looking at 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah. You know, when you buy an Osmocote, which is a slow release fertilizer, it just doesn't magic release at a constant rate over that 90 days. It releases the majority of the nutrients over the first 30 or 45, and then it tapers off to where you've got almost nothing toward the end of the 90 days. Plants, as long as they've received sufficient nutrients, especially nitrogen, have the ability to store about a month's worth of nitrogen.
Mm.
And so there's a little bit of a buffer there, but
we don't want to let it go too long.
You don't want to let it go too long. And since you are producing tomatoes, you're better off not really over-fertilizing, but you have to make sure that they get a constant feed. Now, it doesn't mean a lot, but you're feeding them either every 60 days with that solar release granule or periodically with a houseplant liquid fertilizer.
So the gears are turning in my head, and I'm thinking, all right, so could I grow a determinate tomato like let's see. I'm trying to think.
Yellow pear would be one.
Yeah, yellow pear would be one. If I wanted to grow a larger one and had a larger pot, is that going to work? Or is there going to be enough light?
There's going to be enough light as long as you provide enough light. And so the two systems that I like that have actually been researched by Bruce Bugbee and his research team over at the Crop Phys Lab includes the compact fluorescent bulbs. He recommends something over a 150 watt equivalent, 250 if you can get it, and you can basically put that into a desk lamp fixture that's adjustable and just keep moving it up over your plant. That would be for a super dwarf that is only, you know, a foot wide. If you're doing more, then you would go to a hardware store and get some inexpensive shop lights that take the tubes and keep those 3 to 6 inches above your plants. But cool white bulbs, you don't need to buy expensive grow lights or anything like that. You don't need the LEDs or any of these other more expensive systems. Bruce at this point figures that for the cost of the light and the quality of the energy coming off those lights, that the compact cool white fluorescents are still the best bang for your buck.
You know, I've had great success in my kitchen. I've put up 2 shop lights, and I've got some grow mats that produce the heat, and so that's what I germinate my seeds in, and I keep raising the light as the plants continue to grow on chains, and it works great.
Yes, it does.
And this is in a north window.
Yes, and even that north window is going to be providing some quality light. You know, plants will use 2 wavelengths of light. There's 1 near infrared and 1 near ultraviolet that are the 2 primary wavelengths that they will use. They don't want all light, and the cool white fluorescents are pretty good at producing 1 of those. If you have a window, you're going to be getting some of the other wavelengths that the plants will use, and so it's all the better.
Okay. So what else can be grown? We've talked about the leafy greens. We've talked about the smaller tomatoes. Is there anything
else? Dwarf peppers.
Okay.
And one that, again, the Crop Physiology Lab does sell super dwarf pepper seeds. They're primarily for educational research use.
So why would you have to grow a dwarf one? Because peppers don't tend to
get
big anyway.
They don't get too big, but you're going to have a pot big enough to accommodate the roots, or else it'll get really tippy and floppy and kind of tip over. So you do need a larger pot. But a regular pepper would work, and you would still use those same fluorescent lights.
I think one of the Dandross rules is, it has something to do with the amount of plant shows how much roots there are below. Is it a 1-to-1?
It's about a 1-to-1 ratio. And so for as big as the plant is, you need a pot about of that same volume.
Okay. I was kind of hoping there'd be like a dwarf zucchini or something.
Well, knowing zucchinis, those will probably grow anywhere, but you would need a 5 or 10-gallon pot to do those.
Yeah.
There are some smaller zucchinis coming out, but I haven't seen anything that small yet. I'm trying to think of the other things that we have grown. I mean, there's always the herbs. We're growing rosemary indoors right now. I've been fooling around with parsley, and about as long as you have the light
basil's
and temperature, basil
one.
Is an easy one. I've grown Thai basil indoors, and it's just more, the plant oftentimes doesn't know that it isn't supposed to grow inside. And as long as you provide the necessary adaptations for it or the inputs for it to survive, then it will do fine. And it's just more a limitation of what you want to do to manipulate the situation to do it.
I was hoping that I could grow something like corn, but I just thought, I'm not even going to try
that.
You know,
Bruce does grow corn over in his lab, and he will grow those plants in 5-gallon nursery containers, No. 5 nursery containers, and they'll do nutrient studies and things. It is possible, but
there's so many nutrients you'd have to stick into that plant.
Yes, and he's using low-pressure sodium vapor lamps that are basically street lamps, and so it gets a little interesting. Corn requires a lot of sunlight and heat, and it's just much more than what we can provide.
And so much nitrogen.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Would you go for something like, onions? Could you grow any root crops?
Depending on the root crop, I've grown radishes. Those are relatively easy. The bulb part of the radish is a little bit softer than what it would be outside, but I think it more may be my growing conditions.
It's warmer?
Yes,
it's
warmer. We grew them at the Cache County Jail in their greenhouse, and I've grown them in a window. They tasted good, but they were just a little bit softer, and I think if they were exposed to maybe some 40 or 50 degree temperatures at night, and then the 70 during the day, that would probably stiffen that bulb up a little bit.
Okay.
You could, I've actually transplanted beets and have them work out well. I've grown them, Swiss chard and beets are the same species, and you can eat the beet greens, and so I have never tried to actually mature the bowl, but I have grown beets indoors. Yes, beet greens.
Oh, that'd be great because they make they add such good flavor when you've got a full mix. So if you're doing some other lettuces, you could have some of the beets.
Yes. I like them much better raw than cooked. So yeah, arugula is another one I've grown indoors. That one it really surprises people on the flavor, on how much it can vary depending on the size. And so I really enjoy arugula.
What about insect troubles? I know things like basil tend to draw white flies, but I guess if you don't have them in your home in the first place, then you shouldn't have any issue.
You're not going to get them. And so if you have an area that you're growing your house plants, it's critical that when you purchase houseplants and bring them home, that you look under the leaves, you check the, if you can, pull the plant gently out of the pot to check the roots. You don't want to drag home scales, white flies, mealybug, spider mites. All of these are very hard to get rid of. And if you have to, it's sometimes cheaper to throw away the plant and start over than to go buy a $10 or a $20 product to try to remedy what's already there.
I had an amaryllis several years ago that had been out in the garden. And so I brought it in the house after it had died back in the fall. And then it started growing again. And then it wasn't looking very good. And I got looking down the leaves and there were mealybugs in there. I was so mad that I was bound and determined that these mealybugs weren't going to take over. And it took a while. And me about every other day going in and picking them off by hand. But it's kind of some work once you get
it
in.
It is. And I mean, there are some soil drenches that contain imidacloprid, which has been implicated in some bee death and things. I can't really get into the politics of it, but it has been implicated in a lot of folks just out of
desperation
might go to that, but then you've got a 60 to 98 day wait before you can eat. And it's just better to use good sanitation and good practices to never have to actually go after those insects.
Well, we've been talking to Tom Bettis. He's USU's Extension Horticulturist for Utah County, and our topic today has been growing tomatoes and other leafy greens and vegetables in your home. And really, it just boils down to the smaller items tend to do much better.
Yes, they do, and it's just more, it's not that they wouldn't grow, it's just we can't reasonably provide the resources they need. So the corn and the squash are just still not very reasonable as compared to some of these other smaller and bred dwarf crops.
I'm probably not going to try to grow a celebrity tomato because then it's an indeterminate and it's going to try to go all over the place.
It is.
Even if I have a large pot, but find the seeds that produce small plants and just the small tomatoes,
yes,
and you'll be good.
You know, two varieties I didn't mention that I've talked to people that have had success include Glacier and Yellow Pear. And so if you wanted to get beyond those in the article or just what we've mentioned, those are two that you could also maybe try.
Okay, great. Ton, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Coming up next is our Petals and Pros. Nancy Williams, journalist and beekeeper from Providence, will read from an essay about coyotes.
Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Nancy Williams, and I'm back for another year, I hope, of reading you some of my favorite essays and interesting things about gardens and food and the usual kinds of things that I like to read about. So I have one today that is about winter, and we all know winter garden times in northern Utah are either limited to greenhouse plants or browsing through seed catalogs. So I like to kind of get creative when I'm thinking about winter things to share with you. I'm sharing today a piece just called Winter from the book called A Country Year, Living the Questions by Sue Hubbell. And she's writing this time about coyotes, which are one of my favorite animals. And I know I'm in a minority there, but I have loved them for a long, long time. She writes, "The coyotes are singing almost every night now down in the hollow, the creek bed that runs below my southern boundary. Their song is a chorus of yips, yelps, and barks that increase in intensity and number as more and more join in, until it climaxes in a series of howled wails. I hear them year-round, occasionally down there or over by the river, but it is their breeding season now, and they are singing more often. When I first moved here, their song was rarer. The pair of male Irish setters Paul and I had then would cock their heads and listen when they heard coyotes, and then look at us as if for an explanation of this sound so near and yet not quite of their kind. The dogs I have now, Tazzy and Andy Beagle, are accustomed to the coyotes. However, for here as elsewhere, coyotes have increased in number. They are one of the few wild animals who have spread their range, even as humans have tried to eliminate them. They are shrewd and wily and can eat almost anything. Here in Missouri, their diet is chiefly rabbits, rats, mice, and small birds, but they will eat insects, plants, fruits, and seeds when they have to. They bring back their prey to their den and bury it so they don't have to dig up later when they need it. They are fond of carrion wherever they find it, and they will polish off the kill of another animal and clean up after inexpert human hunters who only maim. Though studies of the stomach contents of killed coyotes show that only 10 or 20% of what they eat are animals men would prefer they didn't, such as calves, sheep, or chickens, ranchers and farmers consider them enemies. Bounties have been placed on their heads, traps and poison put out for them. Still they spread. Back here on the river, I'm the only human who likes to hear their song. A neighbor told me that in some circles, a coyote-dog cross is held to be a superior hunter. He knew a man who had trapped a female coyote in season and held her, snapping and furious, while his prize hound covered her. He kept the coyote caged until she whelped, but she killed her pups as soon as they were born. I'm not surprised after such a mating and imprisonment. I'm also not sure that the story is true, but it could be. Canis familiaris are pet dogs, and Canis latrans, the dog who barks, or the coyote, are close enough biologically to interbreed. They sometimes do and produce fertile offspring. I suspect that Andy Beagle knows more about this than he should. In his younger days, he would go quite wild for a week or so in late January and spend his nights courting, limping back home in the evening. Mauled and bloody, he would stay some hours by the wood stove, whimpering for my sympathy and licking his wounds. By afternoon, he would be restless again, looking out the windows and whining. He would sit in the middle of the living room floor, point his nose to the ceiling, and howl his randiness, and by evening he was ready to hobble out of the cabin and away, only to return again the next morning, his old wounds reopened and new ones bleeding. I always asked around to see any of my neighbors had a bitch in heat, but none of them ever did, and several of them suggested he was courting coyotes. It is possible. If so, he carries the scars of his chutzpah, one long floppy ear in three parts, rather like a split-leaf philodendron, the badge of a knight when he returned, covered from nose to tail with blood that was streaming from the ripped ear. It was the last time he ever went wild in January. He's older now. He spends the month as close to the wood stove as he can get. Perhaps Andy learned something in his final wooing. I did see one encounter of his with a pair of coyotes in which he showed himself discreet, if not valorous, prudent behavior, which indicated to me that he was well acquainted with coyotes and their capabilities. Coyotes are not as sociable as their near cousins, the wolves, but they do often hunt in pairs and are sometimes seen in daylight in the summer after their pups have become active. Our meeting with them was on a summer day when I was stacking logs on the woodpile out behind the barn. Andy had joined me and had discovered the trail of some small animal that had taken refuge there. Nose to the ground, intent on whatever the scent was telling him, he followed the trail out across the field. I straightened up from behind the stacked wood and looked in his direction as two coyotes emerged silently from the woods at the edge of the field above the hollow. Bellies to the ground, they were stalking him, but he was following a scent and was unaware of them until they began to circle. Then he sensed their presence and looked up and yelped in fear. They circled closer. He turned his head to show that he was not aggressive and would have backed off if they'd given him room. The coyotes tightened their circle. Andy lay down, rolled over, and exposed his belly to show his submission. The coyotes surely understood those gestures, for like dogs, they used them among themselves to sort out dominance. But social niceties were not on their minds. They were hunting. They closed in on him, snarling, showing their mettle, showing their teeth, snapping. When I yelled, they looked up. momentarily startled, and in that moment, Andy jumped up and streaked back to the cabin with his tail between his legs. I chased the coyotes, and although they did lope away toward the hollow, they stopped often to look insolently over their shoulders at me. I had won this round, their behavior said, but they were not frightened of me. Now that Tassie has joined the household, she and Andy always go out on their rambles together, and the two of them may be a match for coyotes. I do not know, although I have seen them chase a lone coyote. I am sure, however, that they know more about them than I do. When they hear coyotes singing at night, they do not bark like they do when they hear dogs, but they do not act puzzled the way the setters did either. They listen attentively, file away whatever information they get from that song, and go back to sleep. Coyotes, nothing special. But for me, perhaps because I know them less well, coyotes are still special. I like lying in bed as I did last night with moonlight streaming in the window, listening to their song, Coyote. That name comes from the Aztecs' word for them, coyotl, and should, to my way of thinking, always be pronounced coyote, not coyote the way it sometimes is. Coyote, that word handed down from long ago, a clumsy approximation of their song, the song of wild things in the moonlight. Thanks for listening. This is Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose. See you next time.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.